can we have a Chanukah shiur without talking about the Beis Yosef's Kasha? And the Beis Yosef's Kasha is a very famous one, but in order to properly introduce the Kasha of the Beis Yosef, let us just begin with something that perhaps one might not understand how it's completely relevant to this sugya, but in fact it is. We have a very major discussion in Maseches Yuma Daf Ayin Dalet where the Gemara wants to know, if you look at number Aleph Gufa, Chatzi Shir, when we talk about Isurei Torah and we assume that a kezayis is usher and you're not allowed to eat chalev, you're not allowed to eat any kind of non-kosher item. So generally we assume that there's a minimum shir, how much a person is allowed to eat. So says the Gemara, chatzi shir, what happens if I eat less than the shir? And the Rishonim there point out, it doesn't mean exactly a half a shir. It means if you eat anything less than the shir, how do I know that that is an issue? Rabbi Yochanan Amar Aser Menater. Rabbi Yochanan says that if one eats a chatzi shir, you have violated a Isur de Araisa. Reish Lakish Amar Mutar Menater. Reish Lakish says, what do you mean? If the Torah said you have to eat a shir, and the Torah said you're not going to be punished until you eat a kezayis, that means if you eat anything less than that, it is not considered to be usur at all. And that is the Gemara's discussion. The Gemara comes to the conclusion that the reason why we say chatzi shir usur min haTorah is because chazi l'itztarufe. We assume, how could it be if one little piece of isur and another little piece of isur, all of them are considered to be heter, so then 0 + 0 = 0. That's the way my father taught it to us. How can you ever add up all of those little particles to become a shir and now punish somebody? What did he eat that was prohibited? What did he do wrong? So it must be that chatzi shir Aser min haTorah. Must be every little bit is a shtick iser by itself, is a piece of iser by itself, and then when you add up all those isurim to a shir, that's when you get a punishment. But even before that, you have already violated the iser d'araisa. This is the psak in the Rambam in Machalas Asuros, and the Mechaber in Yoredei and Simon Pei writes the same thing, that we paskin like Rabbi Yochanan that chatzi shir aser min haTorah. The Acharonim have a major discussion about how to understand this idea of chazi l'itztarufe. What exactly does it mean, chazi l'itztarufe? Is this like a gzera of some sort? Now, generally, we don't find gzeros by isurim d'araisa. But is it sort of a gzera that we're afraid if you're going to eat a little bit of chazer and you're going to eat a little more of chazer, then you're going to come to eat a whole shir of chazer next time around because you're not going to be careful? Is that why chatzi shir asa min haTorah? Is that really what it means, chazi l'itztarufe? Or do we mean that the reason why chatzi shir asa min haTorah is because every little bit of Isser really has something intrinsically wrong with it? Not that we're concerned that if you keep it around the house and you start eating it little by little, you're going to come to eat a full shear, but rather because every little bit by itself has intrinsically something wrong with it. So the Noda Yehuda famously comments, what about, let's say, for example, the case that will never come up, but the Noda Yehuda, you know, sometimes talks in the abstract like many of the Acharonim do. So what happens if you have a situation like this? He says the end of Pesach, it's the last moment right before the Shkia, and you still have an Isser Chametz, and you eat a Chatzi Shir of Chametz. So you're not allowed to eat Chametz B'Pesach. Everybody knows it's a Chi of Kareis. But you're not allowed to eat a Kezayis of Chametz B'Pesach. What if I eat a Chatzi Zayis, and now it's Shkia? So now there's no possibility for me to eat the second half and violate the Isser. It's impossible, Chazi L'Tzarufe. So here writes the Noda Yehuda, it would make a difference how you understand what this Svar of Chazi L'Tzarufe is all about. Is it because every little bit of Isser must be usur on its own, and that's how 0 + 0 = 0. If there wasn't anything wrong with all the little particles, then by eating all of them together would also be nothing wrong at all. So if that's the understanding, then even if you ate a chatzi shir of chametz right before the end of Pesach, right before the Shkia, it would still be a problem, because intrinsically there's something wrong with that piece that you ate. On the other hand, writes the Noda Yehuda, if you understand that this is just a gzera, that maybe you're going to come to eat more, and that will be a problem, maybe that should make a difference by Matzoi Pesach, because there is no longer a possibility for you to eat the rest. Rabbi Kiva Eger picks up on the same theme, and he writes in a tshuva, I believe, I don't remember seeing it recently, but Rabbi Kiva Eger has a discussion. What if a person takes a shvua that he's not going to eat this kikar lechem? So what does it mean he's not going to eat it? It means he's not going to eat a shear of this, correct? He says he's not going to eat a bag of potato chips, so it means he's not going to eat a shear of whatever is in the bag. So what if he eats a chatzi shir, and then the rest of it falls into the ocean, and the rest of it gets destroyed, or the rest of it gets burned? Ask Rabbi Kiva Eger, would you say that he has violated the isser of chatzi shir, because you ate something that you weren't allowed to eat, and chazi the sarufe perhaps means that every little piece, every particle of the isser is now considered to be usser on its own, and therefore even if there is no possibility to finish off the rest of the shir, you've already violated the avera. That's tzad number one. Or should you say no, that chatzi shir asa min haTorah chazi l'tzarufe is only because we're concerned if you're not going to be careful with a little bit, maybe you're going to come to eat a full shear, and in this case, says Rabbi Akiva Eiger, there is no possibility to violate the Aveira any longer, because now it's already been destroyed, it fell into the river, or it fell into a fire, and you don't have the ability to violate the Isser in its complete shear. So that is a major discussion with regard to Chatzi Shear, Asur Min HaTorah by Isurim. What is far less well known is, the Gedolim in Europe had a major discussion that basically piggybacked off the Gemara's discussion by Chatzi Shear Asur Min HaTorah. So there was a great Gadol in Europe by the name of the Zecher Yosef. The Zecher Yosef was Rabbi Yosef Zecharia Stern. I don't know much about him. He was Nifter in 1904. He was one of the Rabbanim in Litta, but you see from the way that other Rabbanim used to correspond with him, it seems that they held him in very, very high esteem and very high regard. Rab Chaim used to have correspondence with him and many others. So the Zecher Yosef has the following discussion. He says, the same way that we have this discussion in the Gemara about Chatzi Shir Asim and HaTorah by Isurim, maybe we should say in the opposite direction as well, that when you do a mitzvah only with a Chatzi Shir, maybe you also are in fulfillment of the mitzvah. The same way if you do an Aveira with less than a Shir, you violate an Aveira. Maybe if you perform a mitzvah with less than a shir, you also have some sort of kiyum mitzvah. So where does this manifest itself? Where do we ever have this discussion? So if you look in the Shavus Yaakov, number Beis, the Shavus Yaakov writes as follows, Al dvar mi she'en lo rak pachos mi kezayis matzah. Say for argument's sake you have a person who has less than a kezayis matzah. That's all he was able to get. Nir Ali, he writes, she'en kan chiyuv klal. Writes the Shavus Yaakov, what good is that? You have an obligation on Leil HaSeder to eat a kezayis of matzah. If you don't have a kezayis of matzah, you have nothing. So what if a person, Rachmana Litzlan, in the concentration camp, and all they were able to get was one little morsel of matzah, would you say that there's any reason to take a piece of it? Does that do anything? Or should we leave it all for one person to eat, and they'll be able to be mekayim the mitzvah, and then everybody else won't? What would you say in such a case? Right to Shavus Yaakov, Achila b'kezayis mashma, the Torah always assumes that in order to fulfill the mitzvah of achila, you need to eat a kezayis. If you don't have a kezayis, you have not fulfilled the mitzvah of achila. And therefore he says, if you're stuck in a situation where you only have less than a kezayis of matzah, he assumes in such a case you have no kiyum mitzvah at all. There's just no point to even take that little bit of matzah. And the Mishnah Lamelech discusses it as well, the bottom of the Rambam. And he also assumes for a Dover Pasha that you cannot say that there's any fulfillment of a mitzvah when you have less than a shear. After all, the Torah said, you have to eat, and eating is called a kezayis. If you eat less than a kezayis, you have nothing at all. So this is the discussion that the Shavus Yaakov has, as well as the Mishnah Melech and many other Acharonim. The Shavus Yaakov brings a very unusual proof to his side of the argument. Write to Shavus Yaakov, how do I know that if a person eats less than a shear, that you are not in fulfillment of a mitzvah? So he writes as follows. The Shulchan Aruch writes a case, what if a person takes a shvua shelo yochal matzah? Person takes a shvua, he's not going to eat matzah the entire year. What happens on Leil HaSeder? You have a mitzvah to eat matzah on Leil HaSeder, but you already took a shvua, you're not going to eat matzah. So the Mechaber writes, you're not allowed to eat matzah on Leil HaSeder, too bad. For you it's called Machalos HaSuros. You took a shvua that you're not going to eat it, so now you're stuck on Leil Pesach, what are you going to do? Writes the Shavus Yaakov, I have a great idea. What's the great idea? If you look in the Mechaber quotes the Gemara in Hilchos Shavuos. The Mechaber in Yerodeh writes, if a person takes a shvua that he's not going to eat something, the Yisr only is for him to eat an entire shear. Says the Shavus Yaakov, I have a great idea. Comes Leil HaSeder, you took a shvua, you're not going to eat matzah. Why don't you just take a little piece of matzah? This way you'll be in fulfillment of the mitzvah of matzah, chatzi shear of the mitzvah, and you won't violate the shvua that you took. Because you only violate the shvua once you eat a kezayis of Isser. And you only are mekayim the mitzvah. Perhaps you're mekayim the mitzvah already when you eat a chatzi shear of the mitzvah. So he says it must be from the fact that the Mechaber doesn't give this idea for the person who makes such a shvua. It must be that the Mechaber understands there's no such thing as chatzi shear by a mitzvah. Otherwise he would make this kind of suggestion. From the fact that he doesn't make this suggestion, it must be that chatzi shear by a mitzvah is meaningless. That is the conclusion that he comes to, which is a very flawed argument. Other Achronim say this cannot be. The Chidah writes in the Birka Yosef that he thinks that the Shavus Yaakov simply missed the Gemara. He doesn't understand. When does the Mechaber say that you only violate the Shavua with a Kezayis? That's only with regard to a carbon Shavua. The Mechaber agrees, if a person takes a Shavua, I'm not going to eat something, you're not even allowed to eat a little bit of that something. The only time you are going to be required to bring a karban for violating the avera is if you eat an entire shear, but the mechaber himself agrees that you're not allowed to eat a chatzi shear of the shvuah that you took upon yourself either. And therefore he says he doesn't understand what kind of proof the Shvus Yaakov is bringing. The whole argument is flawed. And the Chida himself gets into this whole discussion about what he believes is maybe a possibility to assume that Chatzi Shir by Mitzvah HaTorah is something that we are able to accept. Writes the Chida, let's look at it together in the Machzik Bracha, number Dalit. The Chida writes as follows. Perhaps we should say that there is such a thing as a Chatzi Shir. And he writes, Shasvara Alimtahi. He says he thinks that there's a strong argument to be made. Sha'arei mida tova meruba mimida peronius. We all know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu always is, mida tova is greater. So if the Ribbono Shel Olam says, when you eat a chatzi shir of Isser, you're already going to be in violation of an Aveira, certainly writes the Chidah, if you're going to do a chatzi shir of a mitzvah, you're going to get some kind of credit for it. It must be mida tova gedola. And therefore the Chidah writes, he thinks that if a person is in a situation where they only have a chatzi shir of matzah, you should eat it, because maybe you'll be in fulfillment of the mitzvah. Other achronim say, let's say you have a chola, and on Leila Seder, the doctors tell him he can't have too much matzah. So how much can I have? So the doctor says he can only have this much. So is there any point for him to eat that matzah? It's less than the shir. We all know somehow the shirim of matzah today became much bigger than when I would imagine a kezayis was. I remember there was someone when I was learning in Eretz Yisrael many years ago. So there was somebody, there was this elderly gentleman who used to come to learn every day. And a lot of the young yeshiva guys who didn't know who he was used to go and talk to him and ask him questions, even though he didn't really know so much. But they used to ask him questions. So there was a guy in yeshiva who wasn't so learned. And I remember he went over to this elderly man and he asked him, you know, it's right before Pesach, I'm just curious, how do we figure out the shear of a kezayis? So the man says, I'm going to tell you the trick. You visualize in your mind the size of an olive, that's a kezayis. That's what he told him. Chiddush, that's what he told him. So I was thinking, you know, sounds very simple, but when you look at the kezayin that we all assume to be the shear of a kezayis, it's much bigger. So if the doctor tells a person all you can have is a small little bit of matzah on Leila Seder, is there any reason for me to do that? Or would you say, once you're not fulfilling the mitzvah, you have no kiyum at all, so there's just no point in eating any matzah? How is this relevant to our sugya of Chanukah? So the Beis Yosef has the following question. We know the Chashmonaim came and rededicated the Beis HaMikdash, and finally, after much deliberation, they figured out how to build a menorah. And the Gemara talks about what kind of menorah they were going to build. Let's not forget, the Chashmonaim were kicked out of Yerushalayim. They were hiding in the forest. They go and fight this war for 3 years. Finally, they come back to rededicate the Beis HaMikdash, and they have nothing left. Who has money? Who has gold? Who has silver? Nobody has anything. And therefore, they come to the Beis HaMikdash, the Gemara says, and they realize all the kelim have been confiscated. Everything's been taken away and sent down to Alexandria Shel Mitzrayim. We don't have anything left. What are we going to do? How are we going to run a Beis HaMikdash? So they decide we have to build new kelim, but they don't have any material to build new kelim. And the Gemara says, you know, when we talk about the Chanukah story today, we talk about how glorious it was, how wonderful it was. It wasn't so simple. It was pretty devastating when you come back to the Beis HaMikdash and there's nothing there, and you don't have any money to build anything and to rededicate it. So the Gemara says they realize, it says in the Torah, you have to build a menorah, miksha te'aseh ha-menorah, you have to build a menorah from a big block of gold. Who has a big block of gold available? Where are we going to find such a thing? And the Gemara says they came to the conclusion, maybe b'dievet, under the circumstances, we can make like a fake menorah, which is what they used. They used a fake menorah. They made a menorah that was made out of some metal, and they made some wood. And the Gemara says, under the circumstances, that was the best they could do. And when they had some more money, they made it silver. And when they had real money, years later, they then were able to build a menorah the way it's supposed to be built. But when the Chashmonaim came back in, it wasn't so simple. So finally they come back in, and they build the menorah, and they don't have any oil. So the Gemara tells us the story that everybody's looking around, and they realize they have to do something. What are they going to do? Because after all, the oil that they used to use for the menorah was oil that came from Tekoa. They used to use olives that came from Tekoa, which the Medrash says was a 4-day travel from Yerushalayim. So what was going to happen? If you travel 4 days there to get to Shemen, then 4 days back to bring it back to the Beis HaMikdash, we're going to have 8 days we have to wait after we just came back to the Beis HaMikdash. We're not going to be able to light the menorah 8 days. How can that be? So they decided we need to do something. Finally, somebody looks and they find a pach shemen. Oh, miracle, amazing. Problem is, it's only a small pach shemen, and that's not going to last us more than one night. So they light the menorah that night, and they realize that there was some miracle that took place. Ask the Beis Yosef, Why do we commemorate Hanukkah 8 days? Why don't you commemorate Hanukkah only 7 days? Because after all, the miracle only was 7 days long. First day wasn't a nes. First day wasn't a miracle at all. The first day, they had enough oil to burn. So what was the chiddush of the first day? Why do we commemorate anything on the first night of Hanukkah if, after all, nothing really special happened that night? All they did was they took the oil that they found and they lit it, and it burned, and it was fine. That's the Beis Yosef's kasha. Now it happens to be some achronim ask a kasha in the other direction. The Minchas Chinuch discusses why by every other Yom Tov during the year do we say that you have an extra day because of Sveika de Yoma? How come by Hanukkah you don't have 9 days of Hanukkah? Everybody's so busy with the kasha, what about 7 days? What about 9 days, asked the Minchas Chinuch? You should have Sveika de Yoma the same way you have Sveika de Yoma by everything else. So you have an extra day of Sukkot and Pesach, and why don't you also have an extra day of Hanukkah? So some Chassidus Shesvarim write the answer is, that's the answer to the Beis Yosef's kasha. Really, Hanukkah is only supposed to be 7 days. But Mishum Sveika de Yoma, we keep 8 days. The problem is it's impossible because in Eretz Yisrael they should only keep 7 days of Hanukkah. Same way they only keep 7 days of some other Yom Tov. So that can't really be the answer. But it's a nice idea anyway. The Minchas Chinuch tries to answer this in his own way. But basically, the question of the Beis Yosef is, Marav is in the main shul. Marav is right next door. So the question of the Beis Yosef is, why is it that we commemorate the miracle for 8 days if really the Nes Chanukah only happened for 7 days and not for eight? That's the kasha of the Beis Yosef. Happens to be the Beis Yosef is not the one that came up with this question. The Rishonim already asked the question before him. The Rush has the question, the Tosfos HaRush, in Masechet Shabbos, in the sugya of Ner Chanukah. And the Rush and the Beis Yosef give three of the same answers. Answer number one says the Rush, we're not going to go through all of them. Answer number one says the Rush is very simple. When they found this one Pach Shemen, they decided to split it up and divide it into eight different compartments, eight different bottles. And they decided every night we're just going to light a little bit and we're going to save some for the next night. That was the idea that the Rush posits. And he says, therefore, from the fact that it burned the entire duration of the evening, that night when they put just 1/8 of the oil into the cup, it must be there was a miracle. Must be there was a miracle even on the first night. How did it burn so long? There wasn't enough oil in there that it should have burned. That's what the Rush answers, that's what the Beis Yosef quotes as well. So the Pri Chadash on the side of the Shulchan Aruch writes, how can that be? How can that be? Don't we know the halacha is Ein Somchan Al Anes? So you find a Pach Shemen, and you're not sure, what are you going to do about the rest of the week? What gives you the right to just put in a little bit and assume that it's going to burn the whole night? After all, the Gemara says in Menachos, we have an obligation when we fill up the candles of the menorah. It says, May Erev Ad Boker. You have to make sure, Tein La Kimidasa. You have to have enough oil in there that it should burn from the evening till the morning. So if you have enough oil, Bifanenu, to put inside of the cup and to let it burn from May Erev Ad Boker, so then how do you have the right to take the oil and save it for the next night? As the Pri Chadash. Just because you're relying on a miracle? And the other Achronim even add to that, and they say, let's say you're so used to miracles in the Beis HaMikdash, you know what's going to happen. What about on Leil Shabbos when you have to light the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash? Leil Shabbos, you're doing a malacha, correct? You're not allowed to do a malacha. The only heter to do malacha is Letzarech Avodah. But if you're not sure that the Avodah is really going to be done, you have a right to rely on the miracle to do a malacha on Shabbos to light the menorah when you're not even sure it's going to do the mitzvah? So how can this be? How do they have a right to do that? So the answer, writes the Zecher Yosef, is it must be that there is such a concept of Chatzi Shir by Mitzvah HaTorah. Because if not, what good did it do them that they just took a little bit of oil and burned each night? It must be, he says, that this whole discussion that the Chida and the Shavuos Yaakov and the Mishnah LeMelech have, it must be that the Beis Yosef understands that there is a concept of Chatzi Shir by Mitzvah HaTorah, just like there's an idea of Chatzi Shir by Yisurei Torah. Why? Because if not, what right do you have to take a little bit of oil? It's going to be mevatel the mitzvah. That, writes the Zecher Yosef, is the conclusion that you have to come to when you read this answer of the Beis Yosef. The problem is, the Magen Avraham clearly says not so. The Magen Avraham writes in Siman Tav Reish Shayin Aleph, there in Hilchos Chanukah, and the Magen Avraham, as far as I know, is in Hilchos Pesach also. It could be it's in 100 other places. I don't know the Magen Avraham that well. But in two different places, the Magen Avraham writes the same thing. And that is, for example, says the Magen Avraham, if I have enough oil to fill up one cup of my menorah, and I don't have enough to fill up all of them, what do I do? Writes the Magen Avraham. Me'ikar Adin, you have to light one candle every night, so you have to fill up the cup, the right shear, and whatever's left over, you put in the rest of the cups, what can you do? But you have to make sure to use whatever you have to do the mitzvah the way it's supposed to be done. And similarly, the Magen Avraham writes, what if a person, for example, has on Leil Pesach, I live in Chutz Laaretz, which means I have Yom Tov Sheni Shogalias, and I'm going to have a Seder on the first night of Pesach and the Seder on the second night of Pesach. And it turns out the only amount of wine that I have left in my house is for 4 cups of wine. Says the Magen Avraham, maybe I have an idea. Maybe I should save 2 cups for tonight, 2 cups for tomorrow night. This way I'll be able to have a Seder tonight and a Seder tomorrow night. I won't have all 4 koses, but I'll at least have 2 tonight and 2 tomorrow. Says the Magen Avraham, no. Your mitzvah tonight is Dalet Kosos. Right? The Chacham Remesakin. You have to drink 4 cups of wine to Leila Seder. You have no right to put 2 of them aside for tomorrow night. The mitzvah that's in front of you has to be done right now. And whatever happens tomorrow night is too bad. So the same would be over here. Even if you explain some chanala neis, whatever it might be, what right al pi halacha, even if you say the chatzi shir by mitzvah satorah is a concept that we think about, but what does it help? What right do you have to do such a thing? Even if you have some sort of kiyum mitzvah, you're not fulfilling the mitzvah the way it's supposed to be done. And therefore I would say the Magen Avraham would be shocked to come to such a conclusion. How could it be that they had a right in the days of the Chashmonaim to split up the oil every night and say, we'll just use a little bit because Chatzi Shir B'mitzvah Haseh is something that we think about. Even if you think about it, it doesn't help. Because you don't have a right, al pi halacha, to split up the oil and take away from the mitzvah B'shleimusa that's supposed to be done right now. Tein Lakim Midasa. That's answer number one of the Beis Yosef. Another answer the Beis Yosef gives is a fascinating one that opens up a very expansive discussion that has far-reaching conclusions way outside of the halachas of Hanukkah. And in recent months and years, this has become a very relevant and widely discussed issue in our community. So let us begin. The Beis Yosef writes, the answer could be possibly as follows. Really, they put in a little bit of oil. And as they were pouring it in, immediately there was a miracle, and the rest of the cup filled up with shemen neis. The rest of the cup filled up to the top, and there was enough oil in the cup now that was able to last for the entire duration of the evening. So the Achronim find that troubling. Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank quotes from Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim asked, I don't understand. The Torah says, Shemen Zayis Zach Kasis Lamor. You have to fill up the menorah with Shemen Zayis. That's real Shemen Zayis. And there are very specific guidelines of what kind of Shemen you can use. So Shemen Neis doesn't follow those guidelines. When you have miraculous oil that comes out of nowhere, how can you use that? How can you say that that is able to perform the mitzvah of Hadlakas Neiros Menorah in the Beis HaMikdash? After all, it's not Shemen Zayis Zach Kasis Lamor. That's the problem that Reb Chaim had with this answer of the Beis Yosef. Now, this opens a Pandora's box into many, many other issues that are relevant to today as well, and it's a very rich halachic topic. Let's look at the story of Avraham Avinu. We go back to Parshas Vayera, and as we know, Avraham Avinu invites in the Malachim, but there's a major problem with the menu that he served on that occasion. El Abakar Ratz Avram. What happens? Avraham Avinu runs outside into the field. Vayikach ben Habakar Rachvatov. Avraham Avinu takes some of the animals that were there. Vayitein al hanar, vayimaher la asos so, and he quickly goes to prepare it. Vayikach chema v'chalav uven habakar asher asa. So Avraham Avinu has all these delicious steaks, and now, next thing you know, he's serving the steak together with the butter and the cheese. How is he allowed to do that? Isn't that basar v'chalav? We would never serve that in our homes. So this is the kasha that all the achronim are bothered with on this pasuk. What does it mean that Avraham Avinu did that? So you'll say, who cares, basar b'chalav? The Torah wasn't given yet. Well, the Gemara says in Yuma Chavches, the same Gemara in Kiddushin writes, Avraham Avinu kiyam kol ha-Torah kula kodem shenitna. Avraham Avinu somehow figured out what all the rules of the Torah were before it was given, and therefore Avraham Avinu would have never violated the Avera of basar b'chalav. So what right did Avraham Avinu have to prepare for the malach and basar b'chalav when he knew that was in violation of one of the mitzvahs ha-Torah? That's the question that they ask. The Pischei Tshuva in Shulchan Aruch Yerideya quotes from the Malbim on Chumash. Very unusual. Pischei Tshuva usually doesn't quote Vertlach from the Malbim on Chumash. But here he writes in the name of the Malbim a psak halacha lamaisa that he thinks is true. And the Pischei Tshuva says, the answer to this question is like the Malbim writes. You know why Avraham Avinu was allowed to serve them that animal together with the cheese and the butter? It's because the animal was created through Sefer HaYitzira. It wasn't a real animal. Avraham Avinu figured out how to create an animal out of thin air. And therefore, when he made this miraculous animal, it's not really fleishiks. So therefore, there's no problem to serve it with the cheese and the milk, and that's why Avraham Avinu had no problem doing that and serving it to the malachim, even though basar b'chalav is asur, but this was not basar. Similar story to what happens in our parsha. What are we told? Vayave Yosef es dibasam ra'ah el avihem. It says that Yosef says some terrible news to his father about what his brothers were doing. Now, What did he say? Rashi fills us into the real story, and Rashi says he told his father that they were eating Aver Menachai. Eating Aver Menachai? What do you mean? The brothers of Yosef, the Shvatim, don't know that Aver Menachai is one of the Shev Mitzvahs B'nai Noach? How can this be? So was Yosef HaTzadik lying? Of course he wasn't lying. Were they violating one of the Shev Mitzvahs B'nai Noach? Of course they weren't. Right, the Shalah HaKadosh, it must be that they really created an animal through Sefer HaYitzira. And they were eating the animal from Sefer HaYitzira. They're ripping off limbs because it's not really an animal. And therefore Yosef comes along and he misses the whole beginning of the story. And he comes along and he sees, look what my brothers are doing. And he runs back home to tell what's happening. Turns out, you don't know that this animal is not really real. This animal was created through Sefer Yitzira. The same kind of trick that the Zayd Avraham Avinu used to make his animal when he served the Malachim. And therefore there was no problem at all. That's the story, he writes, inshallah, by Yosef. That's the story by Avraham Avinu. And that's why none of these issues are real problems at all. So the Ma'arit al-Ghazi discusses this issue as well. And he says, when you have a behema, shenitzer al-yedei neis, when you have a behema that was created through Sefer al-Yitzira, would you have to give matnos kuhuna from that? Or would you say, no, it's not really an animal. Matnos kuhuna is only when you have an animal that's real. So he says, he found a Tosefta that writes, of course there's no obligation to give matnos kuhuna after all. It's not an animal. And the same way Avraham Avinu was allowed to serve the animal to the Malachim, and the same way Yosef's brothers were allowed to eat Avraham and Achai because it's not a real animal, so too, there's no obligation on such an animal to have the matnos kuhuna given to the Kohen. So there's a fascinating Shalah HaKadosh as well. We know that on Shabbos afternoon is when Moshe Rabbeinu died. However, the problem is the Medrash writes on the last day of Moshe Rabbeinu's life, he wrote 13 Sifrei Torah. So the Chasam Sofer discusses, how is it possible somebody in one day can write 13 Sifrei Torah? How can that be? And even if it is humanly possible, which sounds like an impossibility, even if somehow you're going to figure out how to do that, wasn't it Shabbos? So isn't the Melacha of Ksiv on Shabbos? I had Moshe Rabbeinu write the Sifrei Torah on Shabbos. So the Chasam Sofer quotes from the Shalah HaKadosh, the answer is, Hashba'as HaKulmus. No problem. Moshe Rabbeinu figured out how to get the pen to start writing by itself. Miraculously. So the pen was just writing and writing, and then all the Sifrei Torah were written on their own, and Moshe Rabbeinu didn't do anything. He didn't lift a finger. And therefore, he didn't violate the Aver of Ksiva B'Shabbos. Now the problem is, if that's true, how is it called Ksiva L'Gabi Din Sefer Torah? Sefer Torah has to be written by a Sofer. So if it wasn't considered Ksiva L'Gabi Shabbos, how could it be considered Ksiva L'Gabi Ksiva Sefer Torah? So it's a little bit of a problem, but it's the same concept, it's the same idea. It's like the Chacham Tzvi writes, with regard to a golem, the Mishneh Berurah says in Siman Nun Hey, fascinating Mishneh Berurah. Usually the Mishneh Berurah talks about relevant cases that come up every so often. So the Mishneh Berurah says, in the name of the Chacham Tzvi, what happens if you come to shul, and you don't have a minion, you're missing one. So, very simple, why don't we just create a golem? That sounds like an easy thing to do. And that would be the 10th man for the minion. Says the Mishneh Berurah, now that can't be, because he's not really a person. So how can we say that the 10th man for the minion is somebody who's not even a man? He's not even a person, he's not a human being. So we can't count that entity toward a minion, writes the Mishneh Berurah, because he's created through Sefer HaYitzira, that doesn't make him real at all. In fact, the Chacham Tzvi writes, you'd be allowed to murder such a entity as well, because the Gemara says in Sanhedrin that Rava Bara Gavra, Rava decided he was lonely, and he decided it would be nice to have a friend in the world, so he creates a friend, a golem, he creates a friend who's going to come with him. And it says, Havakam Mishtoi Bahadei, every day he was taking walks with him, he was going all over the place with him. And one day he gets frustrated at this golem that he created because he wasn't responding to him. Every time I talk to you, you don't answer because the golem doesn't know how to talk. So Rava decided to kill him. He got so frustrated, he destroyed him. He killed him. Asked the Chacham Tzvi, Rava was violating the Yisra Tzicha. How can you kill a golem? The answer is a golem is not real. He was created through Sefer Yitzira. However you made this thing, he's not a real person. And therefore we assume that wouldn't pose a problem of Ritzicha. And therefore he also wouldn't count for the minion. The Beis Shmuel and Ebenezer Ezra has a discussion. What if a woman is Niv'eles and actually becomes pregnant from one of these, whatever you call them? So the Beis Shmuel says, that's not called a Zona. That's not called a woman who violated. She's not a Sota. She's not anything. You had this imaginary relationship with some person that doesn't really exist. And then you somehow became pregnant from this, you know, whatever kind of human being this is. He says that wouldn't be considered any Isser's Nus at all. There's nothing. So there's a major discussion about this. There's a recent body of research, scientific research, about the fetal lamb. I don't know if people are aware of this. Rabbi Glatt mentioned it recently to me, that there is a scientific area of study where they had a lamb that became pregnant, and after a few weeks of the pregnancy, they extracted the embryo, put it into an external uterus, and it grew to full term. And they think within the next couple of years they're going to be able to do it for human beings as well. So if you have a woman who's not able to hold a pregnancy, all she needs to do is become pregnant, which is a miracle in and of itself, but they'll be able to extract the embryo after a few weeks, put it into an external uterus, and allow it to grow to full term in this outside entity. And the question is, what is that? When that person is born 9 months later, is that called a human being at all? Is that a what is that? What? Oh, so it started out as being real, so you're saying it is real. But that's the question. Is that really true? Is all you need just that it started out being real? Or is it that we require that it should be carried like a normal child? So for example, the Gemara says in Maseches Chagiga Daf Yedalid, the Gemara had a suffix. What happens when you have a Kohen Gadol who wants to marry a Besula, which he's supposed to marry, but he has a Besula who's somehow pregnant? How can that be? Ask the Gemara, is she allowed to marry a Kohen Gadol? So how can you have a Besula who's pregnant? What? What was that? Oh, so Rabbeinu Hanana writes on the side of the Gemara there, I'll tell you what happened. She was Nisabra Ba'an Batya. They used to have public bathhouses. So there was a man who went before her, and then she was the next customer at the bathhouse. Obviously, they weren't there together. She was the next one there, and some of his Zera somehow ended up impregnating her, and now you have a Besula Mu'uberis. And the Gemara wants to know, is such a woman Muteris L'Kohen Gadol or not? Says Rabbeinu Hanano, Zem Maisa Nisimu. That's impossible. How can it be? He says, this is miraculous. If it ever happened, it's a miracle. That's what Rabbeinu Hanano says, and he says, because it's miraculous, he believes, Eina Tmeya Leida. The Torah says, Isha Ki Tazria, when a woman becomes pregnant, V'yalda Zachar, and then she's going to give birth, V'tama Shivas Yamim, and then she's going to be Tamei for a certain amount of time after the Leida. This woman, who didn't have anything natural happening to her until this point, and she was not impregnated the normal way, also would not follow the end of the pasuk, which is Tumas Leida. She would not be Tameya, even though she has Dam coming out, and she seems to be Anida, she seems to be Tameya Leida, but because she didn't follow the natural progression that the Torah describes, she would not be considered Tameya either. So Shlomo Zalman Auerbach talks about this modern-day miracle. He says, what about a woman who somehow becomes pregnant without ever being intimate with her husband, for example, through IVF? What would you say? A woman who becomes pregnant through IVF. Writes of Shlomo Zalman, what's the end of that pasuk? What does it say? Uvayom hashmini yimol b'sar alaso. On the eighth day, the child is supposed to have a bris milah. Zakti Gemara b'yom hashmini afila b'shabbos. You're supposed to do the bris milah even if it's on Shabbos, because bris milah is more important than Shabbos. That, writes the Gemara, is something that would override the Shabbos. Well, if that's the case, writes of Shlomo Zalman, maybe the only time that you say Isha ki tazria v'yalda zachar, maybe the only time that bris milah is docheh Shabbos is when you're talking about a situation where everything happened in the natural course of events. But if you have a situation like this where nothing happened naturally and it happened in an unusual manner, maybe we should say the same way Rabbeinu Hanana writes that woman wouldn't be tmeya later when she gives birth, so too you wouldn't be allowed to do the bris milah on Shabbos if the child is born on Shabbos, which is a tremendous chiddush. But that's where Shlomo Zalman felt. Now, many times I've discussed this with Rav Asher Weiss, and he felt that it was an argument that should not be accepted at all. He said, number one, this Rabbeinu Hananel is a das yachid. All the other Rishonim don't agree with Rabbeinu Hananel, and none of them feel that he's correct. So that's number one. But even if you say we do accept Rabbeinu Hananel, but how is that relevant to our case? Maybe Rabbeinu Hananel is talking about Maisa Nisim, something that's an incredible miracle. It's something you can't imagine. How does it happen? And therefore he says it doesn't follow the regular protocol of what the Mishnah, of what the Pasuk describes there. But when you have a situation like ours, where this is no longer Maisa Nisim, fortunately or unfortunately, we're blessed to live in a generation where IVF is available to people who need it. And therefore he says this is not something that we look at and say, wow, Maisa Nisim, unbelievable. This, you know, when you think about it scientifically, it is unbelievable. But we've all become so accustomed to this reality that it's not such a Pella anymore. It's not a Maisa Nisim like Rabbeinu Hananel describes. And therefore he felt that this is not an argument that should be made, and a bris would certainly be done on Shabbos as well. Now, he pointed out to me a number of years ago that Rabbi Chanan Wasserman writes something that's a very important maramakum to be aware of. Look at the bottom of the page, number Yud. Rabbi Chanan says the following. Why is it that on Shabbos, when it comes to malacha, we say that if you do malacha kila achar yad, you're going to be pater? Why should that be the case? Ksiva, we say, if you're kosev shtei osios b'Shabbos, you're chayiv. So how come when I write like this with the wrong hand, why am I not chayiv? You're still writing. So Rabbi Chanan says that's not something that's limited to the laws of Shabbos. That's something that applies to all the mitzvahs HaTorah. The mitzvahs HaTorah were only said in the normal, natural course of events. If a person is not allowed to write on Shabbos, that means you're not allowed to write on Shabbos the normal way that people generally write on Shabbos. And if it says that you're not allowed to eat some sort of machalas asuras, if you eat in such an unusual fashion, like the Gemara says, shelo kedarach achilaso, you're not going to be chayiv, because that's not called achila. The Torah wasn't talking about you. The Torah, whenever it gave all of its rules, was describing a normal case. And therefore, Rabbi Chanan says, this is not limited to Shabbos, it's not limited to machalas asuras, it applies b'chal haTorah kula. That all the laws of the Torah were only said in the normal case of events. So for example, on Shabbos it says, you're not allowed to violate the malacha of bishul. Says the Gemara, what about bishul b'chama? You take a frying pan, you live in Arizona, and you take the frying pan with an egg, you bring it outside, it's 115 degrees outside, and after a little while, the egg is going to get cooked. So would you say that that's a problem? Says the Gemara, mutar lechatchila. Why? Ein derech bishul b'kach. That's not the normal way to cook. So Rav Moshe has tshuvas about microwaves. Microwaves started to become popular in his days. So he wants to know, is a microwave like bishul b'chama? It's not an oven. So what exactly is a microwave? Says Rav Moshe, no. We've become so used to ovens, and microwaves are going to take over ovens, said Rav Moshe. He believes that microwave is bishul. And soon over time, writes Rav Moshe, the microwave is going to become so important to our cooking process, nobody's even going to have ovens anymore. That was his projection into the future. But either way, he says he can't say that a microwave is like bishul b'chama. If you put your hot dog on the radiator, maybe that's called bishul b'chama. That's not normal. But if you put your item into the microwave, he said that's called real bishul. That's called real bishul, and that's why it's aser on Shabbos. But the point is, the mitzvahs HaTorah were only said for a normal case, not for something that's being done in an abnormal fashion. And that's why all these cases that we describe would not fall under the category of the mitzvah or avera that the Torah describes, because it's just not the same. It's something that's not usual, it's not normal at all. Now we get to the very contemporary discussion, and that is, recently they figured out how to make the lab-grown meat. So they basically took a stem cell from a piece of meat, and they put it into a petri dish, into a test tube, whatever it may have been, and they now were able to produce a piece of meat from that stem cell. So the shaila is, what is the status of that piece of meat? What would you say? Number one, if the stem cell comes from a treifa piece of meat, or a piece of meat that wasn't shechted properly, so does that mean that anything that's a derivative of that stem cell is also considered to be treif? And let's say it comes from a kosher animal. Would you say that now the derivative is considered to be fleishigs? Is that a real animal? What is that? So number one, the first issue you have to discuss, and we don't have enough time to get into all of this, the first issue you need to discuss is, what does the Torah generally say when we talk about something that is only microscopic? So generally the halacha is, the Gemara says in Kiddushin, lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasharis. The Gemara generally assumes that the Torah expects us to live normal, natural lives. The Torah does not expect us to live lives like angels, like malachim. And the Gemara has many different ways in which this manifests itself, but one of them is that the Torah does not expect that we are going to be able to deal with things that are microscopic. So Rav Moshe has a tshuva. There was a dentist, who used to always make fillings, and he was very meticulous in the fillings that he made. So he was always able to see with such precision. So he came into shul in the morning, he would look at people's tefillin, and the Gemara says, Halach al Moshe Misinai, tefillin has to be exactly yiribua, it has to be exactly square. He said, this dentist used to come into Shacharis in the morning, he would walk around the shul, and he was able to see nobody has square tefillin, because he is able to see something that most normal eyes are not able to see. To most of us, it looks square. So he asked Rav Moshe, do I have an obligation to start going around the shul and telling everybody your tefillin's puzzle? So Rav Moshe said, no. L'nit d'tar l'malachei asharis. Rav Moshe has another tshuva about, how do you ever eat vinegar? After all, how does vinegar come to be? We know that there are microscopic bugs that are inside of the wine. And then, after they do their job, it now turns into vinegar. Says Rav Moshe, you know biyadua, when you drink the vinegar, when you put it into a recipe, you know that you have microscopic bugs that are in the mixture. So how you ever allowed to have vinegar? For that matter, how you ever allowed to breathe? We all know there are microscopic bugs in the air. The answer is, l'nit d'tar l'malachei asharis. So therefore, when we talk about anything that's not visible, anything that's not nira le'inayim, The general halacha is you're not considered to be obligated or responsible for that. It's beyond the human capacity of really dealing with things that are not visible to the naked eye. However, Rav Shlomo Zalman says, you cannot apply that principle, let's say, to our case. Rav Shlomo Zalman has a tshuva where he discusses that there was a scientist who wanted to make kilayim out of two stem cells from a plant. So he wanted to take some DNA strand from this plant, some DNA strand from the other plant, put it together, and then they wanted to grow it. He wanted to know, would that be subject to the iser kilayim? So he says, you want to argue that the whole thing is not nira le'inayim. So if you take a strand of DNA from this and a strand of DNA from that, how could it be kilayim? It loses its identity. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman, what do you mean? Maybe the only time the Torah says lo nitna Torah lemalachei asharis is when you're dealing with the vinegar, or you're dealing with, any of the other cases that the Achronim describe, like looking at a blemish on a Nesruv. Do I have to go with the Achronim say you're not mechuyev to go with a magnifying glass and actually look at the Nesruv. You want to be machmer, do whatever you want, but you're not mechuyev to do it. So in that case, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, maybe that's where we say lo nitna Torah lemalachei asharis. But here, where we're sitting under the microscope and studying the thing that's not nira le'inayim, you can't say it's not significant. Over here, this is what we're trying to do. So he says, of course you have to deal with it as if it's here. So the same would be over here in our case. You cannot say lo nitna Torah lemalachei asharis, and therefore, since it's only microscopic and it's a stem cell, so therefore we consider it as if it's not here. What do you mean? But the whole experiment that you're doing is with something that's not nira le'inayim. So you can't deny its existence. You can't say it's as if it's not here. This is what you're trying to study. This is what you're trying to create. And therefore, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes, in cases like this, you have no right to get off easy and say, well, it's not nira le'inayim, so I consider it as if it's not here. Of course it's here. You have to deal with the reality that's in front of you, because in our case, you're specifically trying to deal with that reality. So when I spoke to my father about this a number of times, he felt that in our case, when you create this meat from stem cells, he thought that that is not considered to be real meat. That's like meat that comes al yidei nes. That's like sefer yitzira meat. And therefore, he said in his opinion, he feels that it will only be aser midirabbanan mishum marasayin. It would only be something that we would consider fleshigs midirabbanan, because if somebody walks into your house and they see the piece of meat and you're serving milk and meat together, that would be a problem in marasayin. The reason why that's relevant is because the Ramah writes in Hilchos Chanukah, in case you don't remember, we are talking about Hilchos Chanukah. So the Ramah writes in Hilchos Chanukah, we have a halacha by Chanukah of chashada, that if a person has a home that's on two sides of the street, so you have to light Neres Chanukah on this side and on the other side. Why? Mishum chashada, because someone's going to come and say, oh, how come you didn't light Chanukah licht over here? They don't know that you lit Chanukah licht on the other side of the street. So that's why you have to light in both. Okay. Writes the Ramah, how come today nobody does that? We all have houses, and some people have a window that goes to this direction, some people to the other direction. How come you don't see anybody lighting two menorahs in both directions? Shouldn't that be the case of Chashada? So writes the Ramah, no. Back in the times of Chazal, when they used to light, or in Eretz Yisrael, when they light outside of the house, so then you have to be worried about Chashada. Somebody passes by your house, you have to be worried. Maybe they're going to think that you didn't do the mitzvah. But today, he says, where the Iker Hadlaka is inside of the house, so now the whole nature of the mitzvah changed. Nobody's walking around looking into your house, into your living room, figuring out, did you light, did you not light? Maybe you came home late from work, you came home early from work. Nobody does that anymore. And therefore, he says, since that is not the general feeling when people walk by your house today, when we have the Hadlakas Neres Chanukah, therefore the whole Chashada doesn't apply in our Hadlakas Neres Chanukah any longer. How did the Ramah get, it's like conservative Judaism, how did the Ramah get up and say, oh, you can just throw out the whole din of the Gemara? How does he have a right to do that? The answer is the Ramah gets us from the Rush. The Rush writes in Hilchos Kilayim, the Mishnah says, the Pasuk says, if you have Tzemer and Pishtan, you're not allowed to put them together in a garment. You can't weave them together, wool and linen. However, says the Mishnah, what if I have silk? Silk is not made from wool, it's not made from linen. So what if I have silk? So am I allowed to weave that in together with the wool and linen? The answer is, what would he say? Yes, why not? But the Mishnah says, no, because it's a marasayin. People don't know the difference between silk and wool and linen, and therefore if they see all of these materials put together, they're going to think that you're weaving kilayim together. That's what the Mishnah says. Writes the Rush, v'ha'idna, today? Is there anybody that sees a garment in a store and you can't tell whether it's silk or it's wool or it's linen? Of course you can tell the difference between silk and all the other items. And therefore, writes the Rush, the whole marasayin doesn't apply anymore in our generation, where we have a familiarity with the different materials, and we know that this is this and this is that, and nobody confuses them anymore. Therefore, says the Rush, in a case like that, you would have no problem worrying about marasayin any longer. And therefore the Rosh writes, when you have a Maris Ayin, it has to be lefi hamakom v'hazman. And since that consideration doesn't apply any longer, therefore we have no reason to worry about that original consideration that the Mishnah writes about kilayim being mixed together with the silk. That is where the Ramah gets this psak from with regard to Hanukkah as well, because if it's something that doesn't really have relevance to the generation that you live in, then perhaps the Maris Ayin will be relaxed. How does that manifest itself in our discussion? Well, it comes to be because in our case, let's say over the next 10 years, I don't know, but let's say over the next 10 years it becomes so prevalent that people are going to start using this synthetic meat that's made from these DNA strands. So if that will be the reality, I don't know if it will or it won't. So people are going to become so accustomed to that, it will come to a point perhaps where there's no longer a Maris Ayin. You come into someone's house and their gut reaction when they see a piece of meat is, oh, of course that's the fake meat. Nobody even knows what real meat is anymore. This meat is much cheaper, it's much healthier. If that would be the case, maybe there's room to imagine that then the Maris Ayin consideration here wouldn't be a factor any longer. The same way the Rush writes by Kilayim that it falls by the wayside. In the same way, the Ramah says by Hilchos Chanukah, so the same would be here, that perhaps over time, if we become so accustomed to this reality, it would no longer be an issue. I discussed this with Rav Asher Weiss many, many times, and he was very, very opposed to this whole Mahalach. He doesn't like it at all. And what he said to me, very frankly, was, if it looks like a duck, and it quacks like a duck, and it smells like a duck, then it is a duck. So if you have a piece of meat, even though it comes from a DNA strand, and somehow you figured out how to put it into a petri dish, and now you created another piece of meat, and you're going to say, well, it loses its identity, and it can't really be. He says, the bottom line is, it's a piece of meat. How can you argue that it's a piece of meat? Look at it. Look at it. It has the same texture, has the same feeling, has the same flavor. Everything's the same. What are you going to say? It's like it's not here? So he has a tshuva that he wrote to the OU about this issue. It hasn't yet been publicly published, but you have it on the back of the sheet here. I just gave some of the main highlights of his tshuva, and I think it's interesting to read. You can read it on your own, but we're running out of time. So let me just read with you one very important paragraph that I think he raises here, which is something that's a major theme in his general way of thinking. And that is the following. The paragraph that starts, Ach la'anias daiti. You have that second to last paragraph on the page. Ach la'anias daiti. It's true, I know the Malbim, when he says the story about Avraham Avinu with the Sefer Yetzirah meat. And I know the story about the Shalah HaKadosh where he talks about the Acha Yosef and the Ephraim and Achai and what exactly was the story there. And I know all the Marmakamas, I got it. However, he says, La'anias daiti. Kol eila einam ela divrei drush v'agada. The bottom line is, the Malbim is trying to say pshat n'pasuk in the story by Avraham Avinu. And the Shalah HaKadosh is trying to say a drusha to explain how it was, the machlokes, Yosef and his brothers. Okay, very nice. He says a pshat in the Gemara, it's a pshetel. Ve'ein l'meidin halacha min ha'agada. How can you conflate these two? I don't understand. You're going to bring a proof from that case, from that way that the Shalah argues over there to explain the story of Yosef and the Shvatim. You're going to bring a raya from the way the Malbim explains the story about Avraham Avinu to our case over here? How does that make sense? How can you jive those two sugyas? They don't seem to fit at all. And he goes on and on to explain why he doesn't think that this should be the case, and therefore he comes to the conclusion that he believes this is really considered to be Shema, that this is considered to be Basar Midaraisa. This is real meat. And it's real meat midaraisa like any other meat because it looks like meat and it tastes like meat and it has the consistency of meat and everything about it is meat, and therefore we would assume that there is nothing that would say that this should be considered to be only part of a meat. For all intents and purposes, we should consider it to be basar b'chalav midaraisa if you would serve it with milchix. So, tying back in over here, the Beis Yosef had the kasha. Why is it that we commemorate the miracle of Hanukkah 8 nights? Why don't we only have a celebration for 7 nights? After all, the Nes Hanukkah was only 7 of the nights. The first night, there was no miracle at all. One of the answers that Beis Yosef gives is, you're right. However, the first night was a miracle. Why? Because they put a very little drop of oil in, and then the rest of the cup filled up. Therefore, that was the miracle. They saw the Shemen Eis. It was tangible. Asked Reb Chaim, what do you mean? Shemen Eis is not called Shemen. How could the Beis Yosef say that? So Reb Chaim gives an answer. This is what Tzvi Pesach Frank quotes in his name. Reb Chaim gives an answer. No, must be they put a little bit of shemen, and then there was firepower in the shemen, and it burned so much longer, which sounds like the first answer of the Beis Yosef. So how can that be that's what the Beis Yosef means? So in fact, if you look in the later Brisker Svarim, Reb David Soloveitchik writes, and many other family members say that they reject, there's no way that Reb Chaim ever asked such a question. It can't be that Reb Chaim ever had such a discussion. I don't know why they find it so offensive that Reb Chaim said such a thing. But they say that there's no way that Reb Chaim had such a such a mahalach at all, maybe because it can't be that that's what the Beis Yosef meant. That's, after all, that's what the first answer of the Beis Yosef is. But it's an interesting sugya, and it opens up a whole big discussion that has far-reaching nafkaminas in many other areas of halacha. Do we consider something that comes about miraculously or in an unusual fashion, do we consider that to be the real thing? And do we have to deal with it as if it's real? Or do we say no? If it doesn't come about, all the mitzvahs HaTorah, like Rabbi Chanan says, all the mitzvahs HaTorah were given for the normal circumstances of life. If a person is going to go about something in such an unusual way, like by Hilchos Shabbos you do a malacha kilachar yad, or in a situation where you create something which is not the normal way to create it, maybe we should say in situations like that, that that would not be considered a real entity, and the halacha does not recognize that both le'isser and le'heter. And therefore, in our situation, maybe there's what to argue that in the new research that they have about the synthetic meat, maybe there's room to argue that it shouldn't be considered basar, maybe it should just be considered like power of a meat, even though it might look like it, and it might taste like it, and it might smell like it, or perhaps it might not really be the real McCoy itself. So,